This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Chi. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, I said your name first because you're the only one here today.
There you go. All right. That's good. Good by me.
How are you doing?
Good. So we got even because Jen did one or two recently by herself.
Mm-hmm. One of them. Yeah.
Good. All good. So now we got to even the score. Can't let her get the upper hand.
She got to wind out a lot on politics, actually.
Oh, okay. All right. That's dangerous. I didn't hear it, so it's a good thing. I'm innocent. Whatever she said that was offensive for you, I had nothing to do with it. All right. What's going on?
Well, today we've got some questions. We're just going to go old school and just take them out one by one. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to get straight to it. I guess that was enough small talk.
That's enough small talk, for God's sakes. You got it.
All right. So, dear doctors, what is the ideal level of exercise for one's health? Exercise induces endorphins, but apparently cortisol as well. But little to no exercise leaves one with a weak body, but too much exercise decreases men's sperm quality and stops women's periods. What are your thoughts?
I'm not worried about cortisol. Everybody seems to worry about cortisol. They think that's the reason you're fat and have diabetes and that you die and have cancer. God knows what they think. Yeah, whatever. Okay, so forget about that. The way to look at this is as follows: that you can certainly see that actually, if you look at life insurance statistics, is a good way to look at this. So you'll find that if people don't do any exercise at all, they're definitely more pathological in all sort of ways. Now, once again, this is correlational. So obviously people that are really sick and injured and miserable are going to do less exercise. So it doesn't necessarily credit exercise with the fact that they are in lousy shape. But the correlation is there, so that's interesting. Then once you get away from that bracket, there is not much evidence that moderate occasional exercise versus more vigorous exercise versus extreme exercise really shows anything to speak of. So it's my intuition. And again, even if it did, I think it's clear that you see more pathological conditions with very, very high levels of exercise. People are just putting wear and tear on things, and they're going to wind up with troubles. They're going to, if they marathon, then they're going to wind up with wearing down immune function, et cetera. So I've actually had occasionally in my career people that had gotten cancer, and they felt like, oh, what I need to do is I need to get supremely healthy, and somehow I'm going to defend myself by working out very hard and remaining strong. That's a mistake. In other words, moderate exercise is going to be the way to go. So my guess is that if I had to estimate what I think probably the ideal amount of exercise is for most humans, it would probably be a couple hours a day of hiking on moderately elevated terrain. That would probably, that's going to mimic what human beings mostly did in their natural history. It's not going to be real pounding on the system, but it's going to have just enough of momentary imbalances because you're actually in uneven terrain that it's going to cause the little shocks to the system that are going to make the spinal cord and down through the hips and the legs strong. If you were in the Stone Age, you wouldn't get away from having to lift things or deal with some things that were heavy. You'd be picking up babies, and you'd have to be moving stones around the fireplace and picking up camp and breaking camp. So you wouldn't get weak, and you wouldn't have a lack of intensity on the upper body. So the upper body would remain, the skeleton would remain strong as well. From a cardiovascular fitness standpoint, that is just outstanding. You know, intermediate level stress on the organism, et cetera. That's probably, if you had to do one thing, unfortunately, I live in a flat place. So, and you could say, well, you could walk on a treadmill, but the treadmill actually won't do some of the things that I think are really good, particularly as you age, which is to be on an uneven surface so that you occasionally lose your balance and have to catch it. That turns out to be an extraordinarily important capability that as you age and your brain slowly deteriorates, you want to keep the ability to be good on your feet and to essentially know how to move quickly and grab your balance in case you fall. So that is what you're going to get from hiking on uneven terrain. Believe it or not, I'm even considering moving into uneven terrain out away from the Central Valley where I live now so that I can hike regularly and have that capability. And so you don't see that lack of ability to move smoothly on people that do sports that involve this. So basketball will also do that because you're going to have intermittent stepping and sharp cutting and losing of the balance. That's so, you know what, maybe I won't move for a while.
But a basketball court.
That's right. Anyway, now what else was I going to say? Yeah, so I think that the idea is intermediate level, probably if you did 30 or 40 minutes of almost anything three times a week, we're going to find that you're going to capture the overwhelming majority of benefits that you would get from any exercise program. Okay, so in other words, you need some moderate cardiovascular stress. Beyond that, and that also it appears there's some evidence suggesting that the intermittent bursts of intense work that will drive up blood pressure very, very acutely, that will help actually perfuse areas of the brain that if you did just all you did was mild walking for your exercise into your old age, you may be at greater risk for dementia. And so by having some kind of exercise that you do that pushes you once in a while to where you are really breathing hard because you had to put out acutely for 10 or 15 or 20 seconds several times, that looks like that may be related to protecting people from dementia deterioration. So yeah, it's not as much as the amount of exercise, it's also the type of exercise, and the different types of exercise are going to be potentially addressing protection from various different types of pathological conditions. The main things that I'm worried about is I'm worried about bone health, and I'm worried about cardiovascular disease. I think those are probably the most important systems that are impacted negatively by a lack of exercise. So we want exercise to address those things. But with these things, a modest amount goes a long way. So I have a feeling that a modest amount probably will pull 80% of the value of the ideal amount, okay? And then when we go past the ideal amount, we start in some kind of a decay function where if you're doing too much, you're starting to incrementally do little damages. And if you do too much and you go well over the line because you're a hyper-conscientious, driven, competitive, whatever it is that drives people to run marathons, those processes are actually ultimately to some degree deleterious in most cases. So anyway, that's what I think, and I think that's a pretty good guess as to the state of the science on exercise at this point. Undoubtedly, people can start making a case that moderate exercise, the immune function's better than if you don't do any exercise, and that the immune function's worse if you do too much. That would be another system that we could see that it would be following this very same kind of intermediate level inference. So that's how I think we should look at that.
I remember one time you were explaining in one of your talks that when you were young, you worked construction, some sort of construction, and they were doing so. You were doing so much physical activity, regardless of your actual physical size compared to the construction workers, but you're doing just enough for yourself that you were getting enormously good sleep at the time too.
Yes, yes, and so. Yeah, actually, that's interesting that you bring that up, Nathan, because I believe one of the reasons that many of us are staring at screens till late into the night is that we are under-exercised. And so the if you work out more vigorously, so anybody that tells me that they're sort of insomniac, et cetera, you're not an insomniac if you're working like a Stone Age woman in a village. Okay, so if that is a problem and you have a difficult time sort of closing out your day and falling asleep, that could be a very significant reason that that we actually haven't worked that thing out hard enough. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. All right.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Lyle.
You bet.
Okay, so our next question is, let me just pull up my list here. Sorry about that. So next question. Dear doctors, 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with severe OCD, the checking and infection theme. After 2 years of painstaking efforts, I successfully got off my SSRIs and recovered without the help of therapy sessions. During the height of my OCD, my wife treated me with contempt, frustration, anger, hostility, and a total lack of compassion and patience. She justified that in the past, when we were still a new couple, that I was harsh, critical, and rude towards her. The question is, how can I get over my resentments? I'm extremely high on these three traits, conscientiousness, openness, and disagreeableness, and high on extroversion and in the middle with emotional stability.
How to go get over your resentments. What that is anger. So that's what resentment is. It's just a word that translates a particular type of situation that where we're angry, and we feel angry because we feel like we've been treated unfairly, and so what we're doing is we're leveling threats at the other individual in order to cause them to feel guilty and make concessions. So that's the process that you're actually in. So what's happening is that the threats that you are leveling are not getting you to get her to feel guilty and then make concessions. Because if they did, then we'd be, quote, letting go of our resentment. Okay, so actually, what would probably be valuable, because when I hear this, this sounds like it's a hell of a mess, and it sounds like these two personalities, have not worked out these conflicts. And so I would probably recommend that you book a session with me, quite frankly. That is, I think, probably a move that might be useful for both of you, that we would try to walk through, because probably there's a fairly decent laundry list of essentially unexplored conflicts that are continuing to keep this feeling alive that I've been treated unfairly. And I think you probably need a third party that is skilled and knows what they're looking at to try to crystal clear the behaviors that we're seeing that are essentially keeping this dynamic in place. So, yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to pull this off by yourself, quite frankly. I think you need another pair of eyes on it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Lyle.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Hold on. I would tell you could book Jen too, which she could handle it, but she wouldn't want to. So you better send it to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that it's designed to initiate concessions, hopefully.
Right.
And so does that suggest that the person will remain angry until they get the concession?
Yep.
Regardless of what is said verbally.
They could, or essentially the relationship could modify in other ways to where the CB, essentially has moved around and to the point where they're no longer feeling like they're particularly owed, okay? So, but that could be a long time, including never. Mm-hmm. And so if we're, quote, resentful, we're sitting on top of an open loop where we feel like we've been treated unfairly and we're looking for an apology or a concession in some way. And if we're not getting it and it's not going away, then that that more global CB is not acting as a balm over the top of this thing. Okay. So, I mean, I'm occasionally, you know, I'm in the middle of the bell curve for agreeable, disagreeable. And occasionally, if someone has done me wrong, I will feel that, quote, resentment or irritability. But the interesting thing is that if some time passes 30 days from now, it's a very good chance I'll forget about the whole thing. And then I'll be like, oh, that SOB, blah, blah. And it'll wake it up and it'll be like, whatever. Because whatever the thing was, it was some $100 issue. Mm-hmm. And it's no longer worth the trouble. But at the time, I was, from my perspective, getting shorted on something and therefore, quote, felt resentful. And I was, and I had an anger that was maybe may or may not have been expressed depending upon the more global dynamics of the cost benefit analysis of the entire situation. In this situation, this person's in incredibly close quarters with high level OCD. This is walking all over his wife's life. Okay. And so they've got tremendous conflicts inside of there. And so therefore people have, they had a lot of escalating anger through this dynamic. In other words, because he's feeling treated unfairly, because she's not respecting his OCD and acting with compassion, because she's just seeing it as he's being rude and a bully and aggravating and unstable, probably, and unreasonable as hell. Like, oh, I can't sit out on our patio furniture. No, I saw a spider out there and I'm worried about that spider and that it laid eggs. And then those eggs could, if you sit on them, then you put them in our bed and then it goes into my penis and then I wind up with a poison thing. Like, that's the way OCD works. Okay. All right. And so, you know, from people from the outside that haven't seen it and don't know what it really looks like at close range, the spouse can look like they've got a complete and total reasonable position and they're exasperated beyond belief. The person with the OCD can be like, listen, I don't have a freaking choice. This is what I think. This is how I feel. I need you to accommodate me. And you're being unreasonable and, quote, a lack of compassion to not see what it is that I'm going through and help me. Okay. And I'm going to get angry if you don't honor this, because by God, you have no idea how much anxiety I'm in right now. As a result, all you need to do is do X, Y, Z, and T squared. And if you'll just do those damn things, every then day. I'll be fine every day. And don't miss a trick. Don't touch that bag and then touch your face. And then you touch the, and then you pet the cat. Jesus Christ, I can't put up with this. Okay. That's what it can be like. So from the outside, you know, any normal person looks at this and says, your wife's a freaking saint. She has every reason to call you everything in the book. She's frustrated beyond belief and, you know, et cetera. But somebody like myself who's dealt with OCD knows what it's like, you know, quite well to be inside your nervous system. And I've watched people like yourself and I've interacted with them and I understand it. So I understand what that is. And so now when I look at that, it's like, oh, man, you know, we this is a tough space to be in. So your wife did not have essentially informed consent on this marriage. Okay. And so she didn't know, you know, how deep the water was. And so now here we are at a later date. And now we're looking at this whole situation and it's not happy. And it's not happy because we have an active anger dynamic that's going on. Well, that's not a happy place to be. And so these individuals can't manage to work their way out of it because they've dug themselves into their own position about who the hell was fair and who the hell was unfair. And now you need a third party that can understand both positions effectively and doesn't have any skin in the game to try to help and see if there's any possible way that we can unpack this thing so that these two people can possibly essentially find a negotiation for the nature of their conflicts. So remember, if you're angry, resentful, bitter, whatever the hell you want to call it, it's anger. And it's all a feeling of feeling like you've been treated unfairly. And that might be about money. It might be about status. It might be about you know, other resources, but one way or the other, you believe that you have been treated unfairly. And the most fundamental part of that, even when it's money, the most fundamental part of, quote, you have treated me unfairly, is that you are not valuing me sufficiently. That is actually the esteem dynamic is actually what sits at the root of anger. Whether it's an angry customer at Macy's, i.e., you are not treating me fairly, you're not valuing me as a customer enough. Whether it's, you know, Joe Montana getting traded out of San Francisco, it's like, boy, I can't wait to whip you people, you sons of a bitches, which he did, by the way, too. Okay.
Is this baseball?
No, it's bad. Oh, God. And so anyway, but the point is here, so what we have is two people feeling like the other person has been unfair, and they cannot resolve it. They are dug into their own silos, and it is not breaking apart. Nobody is conceding. And so at least they haven't conceded enough in order to start to unwind these feelings of resentment. So you better get help, because help is probably your best bet. And it's not, you know, it's not a few lines that I could give you here. It's a process that, you know, with a third party that knows what they're doing, you've got a chance to improve the situation. No guarantees, but it's $150 whether we win or lose. All right. That's good, Nathan.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Lyle.
You bet.
All right. Our next question, we're now pivoting to the informed consent of the dating world. Maybe this is pre-marriage here. Mm-hmm. So, dear doctors, I feel like I'm losing my mind in the dating world. I feel like men don't want to lift a finger for a relationship, much less to even meet a girl and even get laid. I feel like I'm a solid 7 or 8 in looks, but in very good shape. Lean, muscular, 5'4", 130 pounds. I have a good job, nice cars, a good long-term rental house. I have a daughter I have full-time, which I understand is an inconvenience. And I'm on a dating site. I get multiple likes or matches per day. Most are less so in the attractive department. I feel like I would settle for a good 6, even if he and most are not in the best of shape. I talk to guys over the app, and they quickly give up. I talk to some longer term. That we meet up. It's like they don't want to put very much effort into getting together. At least 70% of it, I think, has to do with my child, and that takes some work and maneuvering. And no one seems willing to do it. It's like fast food dating or what? I feel like I'm overqualified for most of these men. I'll settle for less, and I don't hardly even get a what's up, babe. It's extremely frustrating and disappointing and makes me second guess every single minute of myself. I wish I could send you pictures of myself and pictures of these men I'd settle for and almost have to chase for their attention. I either must be uncalibrated or miscalibrated, or something has gone majorly wrong in the dating world. Please, if you can give me some honest inputs and hopefully some Lyle laughs.
Well, very sort of heartfelt, attempting to be accurate, and frustrated as hell, i.e., I'm angry because I'm not being treated fairly, and you all should feel guilty for not being into me and giving me more attention and effort. That's what you're hearing. Okay. And so the understandable, been there myself. In fact, I've spent most of my adult life in that state.
There we go.
as have most people, because as we see from the evidence of dating sites, that the average person writing to another person, which almost always it's men writing to women, but it is also women writing to men. The average percentile difference objective in their attractiveness, i.e. as rated by other people, is 25 percentile, which is massive. Okay? It is a massive difference. So this tells you that the average person, there's a reason why I called this the magic 10%. I thought about these numbers a lot. I don't know that there's been too many people from their 18th birthday on have obsessed as much about the mathematics of this problem as me. In fact, there may not have been another individual, okay? There's been people that some gay guy that's the big winner that made his fortune in Plenty of Fish, etc. He's a data nerd that actually it was his article that I read that exposed the 25th percentile difference. That character,
Plenty of Fish. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
I had read one from OK Cupid, but I think
you might have been OK Cupid, but I think he started also Plenty of Fish. The point is, these guys, these guys know a lot, and there's been data nerds looking at this, these questions and evidence for, you know, a while
now.
They're
not academics. They're just
they're not academics. They're better than academics.
Yeah.
Okay,
they have all the data.
They've got all the data, and they can see it super clearly. And they've been curious, you know.
Yeah.
And so what they found was they found an extraordinary gold mine, because what they're selling is hope.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, after my 10 years on Match.com, it's like, God, 10 years on Match.com, and what do I have to show for it?
$1,000 worth of hope.
That's exactly right. Okay. So I would say that you are looking at your thinking is probably quite reasonable. Everything that you're saying actually sounds quite reasonable. And if you're a 7 or an 8, the people who would be, let's split the difference and say you're 7.5 on average. In other words, you're somebody's 8.25 and you're somebody else's 6.75. You know, maybe you're somebody else's, you're somebody's 8.5 even. In other words, that's the magic 10%. So let's suppose you're objectively 75th percentile. There is some modest percentage of males that would consider you 85th percentile. They happen to particularly like your particular style and look. And then there's some other men that would actually only consider you 65th percentile. But most people would be, the vast majority of males would rate you between those two. Fair enough. That means that we would expect, if that were true, that the average person that would be writing to you with a sincere interest would be at the 50th percentile, okay? So if you're saying, I'd settle for a 6, it's like, yeah, well, the 6s, not too many 6s that you would consider a 6 would be interested, incredibly. As outrageous and insulting and unrealistic as that is, these apps have actually showed us some important truths about essentially human calibration. And we can lament this, and we can jump up and down and swear, and we can be irritated and say that they're also incredibly unreasonable. But what you're actually watching, and you don't know it, is you're actually watching how difficult it is, specifically with respect to males, to be willing to commit to long-term investment strategy and pair bond strategy. So long-term pair bond strategy is a very dicey genetic strategy for the male. It is by no means the best strategy for reproduction. And so it is unusual for them to actually, you know, really commit. Okay, they're not typically that committed. When they are committed, it's because they feel really pretty substantially over-rewarded. They really feel that way. And so it's not easy. It's not an easy situation. And now instead of the magic 10%, you know, what the geniuses from OkCupid are telling us is it's the magic 25, okay? And actually, maybe more accurately, it's the magic 12.5. In other words, we might think that some guy who everybody else thinks is 50th percentile, we think he's 62.5, okay? He thinks of himself as a 5 because he's halfway decently calibrated. However, he thinks somehow he earns a 7.5, okay? And so it's tricky because very few 7.5s, he's at the outer reaches of what they would accept, and they probably wouldn't, because most females are probably not willing to go down that far. They might be willing to go down 20 points for an extraordinary prospect, but usually not. That's why you usually don't find people mismatched by 20-25 percentile. Usually they're only mismatched by 10 percentile. And so the truth is that why you think I'll take a 6, but the 6 that you say you're, quote, willing to take is probably an objective 6.5. Okay? You're like, well, I'd go down that far. Whatever. Anyway, before we get lost in the numbers, which we already are, the bottom line is that your best hope is to fish where the fish are. And where the fish are is not on any dating app that has any hint of casual mating strategy. Okay, so that you better go to where that where it's blaring pair bond strategy from every microphone and every speaker. And that's going to be eHarmony. Okay, so I wouldn't bother going on anything other than eHarmony or Match if I was if I was a woman, you know, that's where I would be going. Unless you are more adventurous, don't mind, you know, don't mind sleeping with half, 4 or 5 different guys in a year, as, you know, hey, we try it out, we see how it goes. In other words, if you are more open, I have no objection to this. And if you enjoy the casual mating strategy, dance, no problem. Go on Tinder and have yourself a grand time. That is definitely the minority of females that I have ever run into and that I have ever talked with any counsel. And so most of them are, even if they think they're open like that, it turns out they're really not that open like that. And they're operating as tar pits. And when they're doing that, they're essentially trying to draw in a fancy male by acting like they're all cool and casual, when the truth of the matter is what they really want is a pair bond strategy. So very, very often that turns from, hey, no problem at all, let's just have fun, to how come you didn't call me? What are you doing? Where are we going? How come we never make any plans? That's about how fast that takes, about 3 weeks for that to happen. So most women are pretty conservative, not all, but most of them are, and most of them want somebody that is leaking all kinds of cues that you are really fancy and you are essentially a terminal target. In other words, this is where I want to be. This is where I want to end my search, right here with you. That's what the female mind is searching for. She's first searching for that kind of feedback. For you to get that kind of feedback, they're going to have to feel over-rewarded. Okay. And so your basic strategy is right. But whenever I hear, quote, apps, they swipe, I get likes. I don't know that stuff is even currency on a thing like eHarmony. So look there and, you know, write yourself a legitimate, profile that talks about you as someone who, you know, it doesn't have to be grim, but you're a serious person. This is what I do for a living. You know, I have a 9-year-old daughter. You know, this is the kinds of things that I like to do. This is what's important to me in life. And I'm hoping to find a long-term partner find someone to share the journey with. Yeah, there you go. We put it out there in pleasant but firm discussion. And I can tell you, as someone who read anything like those words never dissuaded me one bit. Okay. Anybody that was acting like a good time girl that, hey, I have to go out and party and have fun with my friends, it's like, you know what? That sounds like superficial dog shit to me. And besides, you're too extroverted and frivolous. No, I wanted to hear some thought about life and future and things that you would like to do, etc. In other words, I want to hear something like that. And if you say hoping for a long-term relationship, boy, that is in absolutely no way dissuading me.
Not hiding it, basically.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so I'm sure as hell completely unmotivated to bluff somebody, for God's sakes. So this is where I would go. That's the best advice I have. And you know, you can bet that it's going to be frustrating, and you're going to need to be patient and keep putting the effort out. Because why? Because we've got obviously a pretty striking inherent narcissism that protects people from not idealizing long-term negotiations. In other words, you got to make me an offer that I can't refuse. That's kind of where this is, and you know, it can be frustrating to live through that process, but that is the process. Okay, that's why if we ever get anything that's real and really good, it's an extraordinary event and an extraordinary celebration. Okay, so, but most of the people that go to altar are already past the delusion, and they're going through with it anyway because they agreed a year ago. Oh well, that's why you should never get married, folks. You should discover that you are. Okay, so you know, wait a long time. You're living with the person. You know the person. You have been through some serious trials and tribulations together, and you're waking up realizing, I don't ever want to be anywhere else. You are married. Then you can go get married. That's the time to do that.
Wonderful, Dr. Lau. Thank you
all
so
right.
much.
Very good.
I had a question about those apps. Yeah. I can't help but wonder if the males And also females, because they see so many options on there that those numbers skew what they think they can get. So if I'm on there and I'm seeing 10 after 10 after 10, it's like, well, might as well try for only all those.
Yeah, that's actually super interesting. I have no doubt that that's true because the as Jen said, called me up one day and she said Twitter must or no what is it what's
oh,
it called
Tinder.
Tinder must die. You know what I mean? She just feels all of the psychological calamity that's coming as a result of this. And one of the things is you see your options, but you don't see any of your competition.
Right.
Okay. So I can look at 300 women and there's no men, and I'm like, well, look at the top 15% of these women. There's 45 very nice looking women here that are in my age group, et cetera, et cetera. So, gee, that's good. There's 45 of them and there's one of me as far as I'm concerned. So I think that
it's
almost impossible for that not to cause that kind of, and that's probably, interestingly enough, and I will say something else that's really great, Nathan, that you brought that up. And that is that that's probably the reason why it's a 25 percentile fiasco. Because the truth of the matter is you don't see that at church and you don't see that at school.
Right.
People are extremely reasonable when they're not extremely reasonable. They're a pain in the ass and it's difficult. But you see people trading comfortably in the magic 10% arena.
Yeah.
But I think that these apps, literally the nature of this thing has caused people to have this rooster in a hen house mentality on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting because I didn't even think about you're not seeing your own competition. Because if I'm at a gathering party, speech, conference, whatever, and I see an attractive woman, but then two guys who are just, beating me up and down, in every department are going to go up and talk to her and she's having a good time, I just have much less likelihood that I'm going to go try my hand there and for surely lose.
Totally. That is absolutely Party Calculus 101 is exactly right. And I think that's what's missing, which makes that a great business to have been in, and these guys know it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Match.com, all these guys that started these things, sold out to Match.com for $500 million. And they're laughing all the way to the bank because they're just sending little people in a circle at $19.95 a month, and it won't stop. And occasionally somebody gets lucky. It's not like it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I went out on a lot of dates on Match.com, but the it's better than nothing.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that it's solving the problem very effectively. Fortunately,
right.
The problem has largely been solved. But we're going to share that with the world in another day.
Okay. Yeah, that would be interesting if you match with the girl, but you see all of her other matches.
Yes.
I'd be a lot more motivated to really craft a message if I thought that I'd beat them all out.
Oh, that's exactly right. And in fact, that's exactly right. There was a lady that wrote a very thoughtful, intelligent profile on Match.com in 2014. The reason I know is that I just got together with her 2 weeks ago, and we remained good friends. We dated for about 2 months, and then it didn't fly. But she was a wonderful person, and she was attractive. And I looked at that, and I actually thought I got it in my journals. Like, okay, I now am going to use everything I know because I know I've got a lot of competition. Okay, and I wrote the most humorous, insightful, heartfelt-looking, deep. You know what I mean? I spent probably, an hour and a half on that two paragraphs being as crafty as I could, because I was determined, because I knew that there was 100 other people hitting on her and she was out in Silicon Valley. And I'm like, forget about it. There's at least 8 guys there with net worths over $10 million that are probably writing to this girl. It's not like she was super fancy, but for our age group, we were older, and it's like, uh-oh, I'm up against some major, suede shoe MFs right off of Sand Hill Road, okay? This is going to be trouble. And she was not, didn't find my photograph appealing, but she couldn't let herself go. She said it was too interesting. And so we wound up, becoming very good friends. And what is this about? the effort that I put in. Mm-hmm. I never put in more effort. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so exactly as you're saying, Nathan, I had been beat up too often on Match.com for too many years to not know how much competition I had. Mm-hmm. And so I actually went to the trouble of doing an exceptionally good job. This gal isn't seeing that because it's once in a blue moon, you're going to get a guy that knows the competitive problem and understands right. He better get off his ass. So yeah, we've got, but I would start with the most pair bond oriented apps that there are. And that's where that's the only place I'd be fishing.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. Now, I remember also one, from that study, either Plenty of Fish or OkCupid, yeah. They said that almost all the women would only swipe on the top 15% of
yes.
males.
Right.
Essentially. So
yeah.
It would just
make sense.
And the males, obviously the males will swipe on almost anything because
they've right.
got the casual mating chip.
That's too. What, yeah, that's yeah. i.e. Jen's Tinder must die because the women are getting really false feedback mm-hmm. and so they don't actually know where things really are.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
All right, maybe one more.
Yeah.
What do we got?
Perfect. Thank you, Dr. Lau, so much.
You bet.
All right. Dear doctors, I will be graduating from cosmetology school next month. As a professional hairstylist, tips will make up a significant part of my income, so I'm curious about the psychology of tipping. Is there anything that I can do to increase my chances of receiving a generous tip from my clients? Or is there anything I can say or not say to my clients that has any impact at all, or somehow that I can make them feel good? Does my appearance or manners have anything to do with tipping?
Here's what you don't see. Oh my God, what happened to you? No, I think that tipping is going to be a derivative of there's going to be little derivative processes there, and one of the processes is going to be that they feel like they owe you more than they're charging. Okay. So that's why restaurant people, if they can get away with it, like, oh, I just gave that to you for free. We didn't charge you for that. It's like, oh, well, in that case, I'll tip you. Okay. So everybody that's worked in a restaurant at some point understands how clever that is if you can get away with it. So one thing that we know about, incidentally, restaurant behavior and the factors in tipping, I don't remember the study, but I remember the results, and the results almost couldn't be true. So but I'll tell you what they were, or at least what I remember, and it doesn't matter that they couldn't be true because it's the right direction. So what I recall is that I feel like I read this in David Buss, or it might have been Miller. I can't remember, but that what they had a waitress do was to write down everything that you asked and then feed it back to you word for word. It turns out that when the waitresses did that, as opposed to listening carefully, in other words, memorizing in your own head and then saying, absolutely, you know, very good, and then going away and leaving, right? So, oh, you're the genius that can actually keep all of these details in your head. It turns out that actual customers are absolutely relieved and grateful. They don't want you to be showing off and looking like a genius and then messing it up. What they really want is they want you to get it right, okay? And they actually appreciate the conscientiousness that and the non-grandstanding that actually you wrote down everything and then you read it back. And apparently, Nathan, from what I remember, the tips were double.
Wow.
Which is extraordinary. You know what?
So you're saying the tips were double.
You just had to say it twice. Yeah. There you go. So the point is that I've thought about that study, and I'm not sure what all the elements are. But I always feel like when they don't write it down, they're grandstanding, which is them trying to use this as a sexual display to show me how fancy their mind is. And that they're essentially corner cutting on something that would be useful for me, which is to take it out of your pocket and write the damn thing down so we get it right. Interesting. So it feels fancy to the waiter, but actually to the customer, it actually is a signal that you don't value me that much and you're actually trying to save energy, for God's sakes. Okay? And so the when you write it down and then repeat it, you are going to two sources of extra effort. Like, oh, you could have been so smart that you didn't even have to write it down, but you actually did write it down, and then you fed it back, and let me make sure I got this right. You're having this, you're having this, you're having this, you're having this. You know, whenever anybody's done that, which is only one waiter or waitress out of 50, but whenever they've done that, I'm relieved. It's like, oh, they got it down, no cheese.
Yeah.
They got it down.
Or you know, fried tofu.
Right, whatever. Yeah, we just last night we did this.
Yeah.
And didn't he mess up two things?
Two of them.
We had a very simple order. We went to a Japanese place, and we ordered the vegetarian sushi rolls and edamame. And then we ordered the spring roll, which we thought were not going to be.
No fried.
I called them earlier
today just to confirm, too.
Unbelievable.
Just like raw rice paper. That's all we wanted.
And then when the things came, we wanted it, the tofu and the things to be
not fried,
but it was.
Yeah.
And it's like, there you go.
Yeah.
Like we just walked away from those rolls. The guy came later like, you okay? Like, yeah, we're fine. Whatever. Nathan was all irritated.
Yeah, Dr. Lau was really nice. I almost sent it back. Dr. like, no, it's fine. We'll be okay.
No, it's not worth the trouble. So, but that's an example. So, if you're a hairdresser, certainly we're going to do the basic esteem dynamic processes. We're going to call them by name. We're going to ask them questions, and we're going to give them compliments. Okay, so these are really basic things. Now, so you know, you might even want to think about questions and compliments that you know make yourself a little list of them at the beginning of your career about what questions you know are really safe and easy to ask. If you're not particularly social and extroverted, it may not come supernaturally to you. So, you know, get yourself 10 questions. And then also, even keep a little list in your little drawer, because then when you ask a good one and it works, then go write it down after that client. And you just incrementally made yourself a little bit more socially skilled and you build up a repertoire there. And then you also are going to do the same thing with compliments. So you're going to be thinking about compliments. You might be listening to your colleagues and sometimes compliments that they exclaimed to one of their clients. In other words, you're looking for reasons to compliment. Now, it's not going to be a barrage. This is what I call, you know, the 110% rule. So whatever it is that we're complimenting, we add 10% extra juice, not 30%, because then it looks, you know, basically disingenuous. So we don't want to do that. We just want to up it a little bit on the high side because we're friendly and animated and hoping to do a good job and hoping for them to like us and then hoping for them to pay and tip us and come back. So it's not unreasonable that we're going to be slightly amped and a little bit extra sauce on our compliments. That's fine. But most importantly, and more important than those things, is going to be asking them that they want carefully and then feeding it back. Okay, that's letting them know that you're not the genius that knows what to do, that you're paying attention very carefully to what it is that they want, and you're going to do your level best to give it to them. And that is, that I think is the most important thing. There would probably be other things that you could do if your women's hairstyle, because they're more complicated, that you could probably even when you're done saying, I think this looks awfully good. I think you look great. How would you see it, you know, if we were going to alter it next time and do it slightly different? Are you having any feel for how we would do it differently? Okay, you might even do that. In other words, you're building a really collaborative notion that you are really paying attention to, and what's important to you is how they feel. You did your best to give them what they want. You think they look good, but is there anything about this that didn't quite match up with what they were envisioning? I think if you do that as a hairstylist, you are 1 in 100. And I think you'll do very, very well with that.
Dr. Lau, do you see a value in, say, this person, say, maybe calling up a few other long-term cosmetologists, maybe in a different city so it doesn't feel like it's competition, asking them, oh, what are some things that you've done that improves tips? Or is that kind of too crass?
You know, I don't think that there's – I doubt that there's anything special. No. The truth is I think that we – probably know more than the cosmetologist knows. In other words, this uh, most of them are very perfunctory with these specific questions. In other words, they're hoping, they think they got it right, now they're going to go do their thing. Mm-hmm. And they're hoping that you like it, you know what I mean, et cetera. So I think that you're not going to violate people's expectations spectacularly with any gimmick that's going to do anything. But these little details that I'm giving you, I think are probably the most important little places that we can put our finger on the scale. Okay?
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dr. Lau. So,
good.
All right, Dr. Lau. Well, it's been a lot of fun. It's a little old school, but we're in person together. So,
cool.
Yeah.
All good. No, great. And, oh, gosh, we have to have Jen back next time?
Yeah. And if you guys want to hear Jen and Dr. Lau, go to esteemdynamics.com. It's a really wonderful library, living wisdom library.
Remember, whatever she said politically, I'm not responsible. Oh, yeah, we love her. We can't wait to be back. All right. Very good, Nathan.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Dr. Lau. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.